Welcome to the Binder Family Speaker Series, a podcast dedicated to high-level research on contemporary anti-Semitism by fostering productive and collegial discussion of the most pertinent issues before us. Hosted by the Indiana University Institute for the Study of Contemporary Anti-Semitism. For more information about this speaker series, ISCA news, or videos of past webinars, please visit our website at isca.indiana.edu. And now to present our speaker, Dr. Alvin H. Rosenfeld.
And special thanks to you, Elchanan. It's good to see you, if only over Zoom. But if all goes well, we'll make a change for the better. Look forward to seeing you in Tel Aviv. You've been to Bloomington more than once. You even taught here as a visiting professor. So our friendship goes back many, many years. Those of you in the audience who do not yet know Professor Yakir will be in for a treat when he speaks to us very, very shortly. I came to discover him a number of years ago when I read this book by him called Post-Zionism, Post-Holocaust. It was one of the first and most seminal understandings of the phenomena of denial, forgetting, and people looking to delegitimize Israel. It's a book I strongly recommend to all of you interested in that subject. I just learned, in fact, that Professor Yakira is working on a sequel, which will update some of that material. But we don't have to wait until the sequel to appear because he's with us today and will bring us up to date on his thinking about these matters. He's extremely well equipped to do so. He did his studies first at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. He then went off to France and did a PhD in philosophy at the Sorbonne. He taught for a number of years in the philosophy department at the Hebrew University, and he remains active on several fronts to this day. Elchanan, it's my pleasure now to turn over to you.
Okay, thank you very much, both Alvin and Günther, for inviting me to make this talk. And it reminds me of the long time that I spent in Bloomington, and I must say I feel that I would miss it very much. I miss it. I missed Bloomington. I have very good memories from this nice city. Anyway, but today we are going to talk about a little bit less nice subject, which unfortunately it is now in the center of our preoccupation. So the title is indeed Spinoza, Arendt, and Contemporary Israel Bashing. But it is, of course, impossible to begin such a talk today without referring to what's going on in Israel and in the world, the war and everything that surrounds it. And I'll try to be brief, but I have to say a few things and also clarify, by the way, my standpoint on these issues, which are all very much very controversial in Israel and outside it. So let me say this at the beginning. Israel is going now through the worst crisis since its creation. The massacre of October 7th, the atrocities that were committed, I'm sure that you know about it more or less. The question of hostages, there are still some hundred people held in Gaza by Hamas in apparently terrible conditions. And God knows how many of them are still alive. Certainly not all of them, and many, many bodies there too. But all this is only the most conspicuous elements of this unprecedented catastrophe. The real crisis on Israel, however, has a more to it than just the war. It is a political and moral crisis. And if there is an existential threat to Israel, as some people say, I believe that it is due more to what's going on inside the Israeli society and the political scene than outside. We shall win the war. I'm certain. Actually, we are already winning it from the military point of view. But everything that surrounds it looks very bad. The war itself looked bad as well, as everywhere, every war. But I think the Israeli military is doing very well. Anyway, so in order to give some indications of what I think about this ongoing crisis, let me give you three, let me mention 3 points. I'll do it by telling some incidents instead of elaborating in a more abstract way. I don't know if you heard about it, but was a recent storm everywhere, every day in Israel. More or less, there are at least one storm in the public scene. And one of the latest, a few days ago, was steered by a discourse of a Brigadier General Dan Goldfuss. I don't know if you heard about it. He is a general, he is a very appreciated combat officer. He actually led the forces which were doing the most difficult missions during the war. And a few days ago, he gave in the field a discourse that was filmed and broadcasted, and everybody heard it, in which he urged among other things, he urged the politicians to be worthy of us. Meaning by this us, first of all and foremost, of course, the fighting soldiers, the fighting forces, but also many other people around it. But this exhortation of you have to be worthy of us implies something much more serious. It implies that you are not worthy of us. If you were worthy of us, there was no point of urging you to be worthy of us. Think about the politicians. And many people, including myself, think he was right. The actual leadership of Israel is not worthy of the Israeli society, or at least of these parts of it which pay the taxes, which go to work, and which fight in the wars, which do the Miluim, and everything is on carry all on its shoulders. But the leadership is something else. Of course, there was, as I said, a storm. So many people embraced what he said, but objected. Obviously, the fact that a soldier, an officer, comes forward and talks like this. But maybe I'll say another word on it soon. Another example of the crisis. A few days ago, I read in the Mosaic, in the news, in the newspaper Mosaic, Elliot Abrams' attack on Chuck Schumer's, and he said, I quote, "Unprecedented and indefensible criticism of a Democratic ally." True. But he was right, unfortunately, in every word he said, Chuck Schumer's. So, what I want to say by these two examples, and there are many, many others, is that, alas, the present Israeli political leadership has created a disastrous situation in which such gestures, which are absolutely unacceptable and unthinkable before, are now all over the place. And these are only two examples, of course. You know, the crisis with Biden and the American support to Israel is something with can have very grave consequences. I won't elaborate, but this is we can, if this is not the topic, but if that question afterwards, I would be able to explain it a little bit better. Another storms that happened, a few which make an important part of the crisis in Israel, is one of the two chief rabbis. You know, in Israel there are two chief rabbis. One is Sephardic and the other Ashkenazic. The Sephardic chief rabbi said the other day that if we, meaning this is another we, meaning the Avrechim, the yeshiva students, and the Haredim are forced to serve in the army, because they don't serve in the army, and we can elaborate on this too afterwards. If we shall have to go to the army, he said, we shall pack and go to live abroad. We'll learn. We'll book tickets in El Al, and we shall fly somewhere and live there. And there is an ongoing discussion in Israel, which is since many, many years, about what we call in Hebrew shivyon banetel, which means roughly equal burden. And there are the we that Goldfuss referred to, the we that carry all the burden, and those who carry nothing, don't work, don't pay taxes, mostly, or often don't go to the army, etc. And this is a problem that is debated in Israel in years, many, many years back. And now, because of the war, because the army now needs, is in bad need of more soldiers, with all that's going on, this debate has erupted again, and so far hurt with a stark refusal by the Haredim to take part in what's going on in Israel. And this is also part of the the crisis. And there are other dimensions to it, and I'll only mention very briefly, I won't go into it, that the, well, of course, the October 7th was a huge failure from all points of view. Military, the military wasn't ready, and there was no intelligence. And, well, I'm sure that you more or less know about it. However, the military redressed in no time. After unbelievable catastrophe of 10 October 7th, the military has organized itself in no time, and it has been fighting very well in Gaza ever since, and in the north as well. Don't forget that there is another war going in the northern part. But the government, the civil society in Israel also has done marvels. Immediately, the moment the things had started happening in around Gaza, the civil society was there. The government is still not there, or doing very poorly. So this is also part of the now, one thing that I guess people outside of Israel know better than we hear us here is the reaction of large segments of Western society to the ongoing disaster here. The war itself, the hostages, the evacuation of hundreds of thousands of people from, you know, the north and the south, etc. This upsurge, new upsurge in Jew and Israel hatred did not come as a surprise to many of us. What we witness now in the streets, in the campuses, in social networks, large parts of the media, in the left of the Democratic Party, sorry, it's just the latest manifestation of a process that began long ago. At least from the early 80s. The early 80s was the Lebanon War. I happened to be then in Paris. And what I witnessed there was, for me, shocking. It was a promo, but a strong one, to what is going on today. Less violence, physical violence, but otherwise exactly the same. But it was still contained. And then the next stage was the Second Intifada, which is interesting in many ways because the eruption happened is at the time where Israel was still negotiating in Camp David. With the Arafat and the Palestinians, and the Israel agreed to withdraw from the West Bank and from Gaza and to create a Palestinian state. And especially at this moment, there was a new eruption of anti-Israeli discourse. And then we understood, I think, that the issue has not been, as many of us on the Israeli left, and I more or less consider myself to be part of it, thought was the problem of 67. We believe that if we withdraw to the 67 borders, a peace will come. But then we discovered back then in about 2000, this was the time when I began to work on this book that Alvin just mentioned. Then we discovered that the question, the issue was not 67 but 48, and actually 1917. Just the other day, I don't know if you saw it, but a pro-Palestinian activist, a woman, came to the I think it in Cambridge, there was a picture of Lord Balfour, and she spread it with red color and then cut it with a knife to shreds. So it begins there. So the issue is the basic recognition of the basic recognition in a Jewish case on the land of Israel. And this is what happened in 1917. The British Empire and then the international community recognized this right and the demand of the case made by the Zionist movement for a self-determination of the Jewish people in the Eretz Israel, in the land of Israel. And this was refused symbolically by this woman and et cetera. And so I think we what we witness, and nowadays today what's going on the streets and campuses, etc., is obviously, I think, can be seen as a Judeophobic anti-Israelism. There is a strong sense of and feeling of hate and rejection of Israel, and it is. In it is one with a kind of Judeophobia, hatred of the Jews. It comes together. One important feature of this anti-Israelism, which is discussed quite a lot, and there is one feature is discussed less, and when it is discussed, I think it's not discussed enough. And this is what also so I saw an article the other day in commentary under the title in one word, as a Jew. I don't see if you, I hope show it. It was written by someone called Ellie Lake, and it was the title was A Brief History of As a Jew in One Word, and subtitled Using Your Faith Tradition to Slander Your People. And the article begins by a quote, quoting one woman, I don't know who she is, Sally Hunt, I don't know, and he quotes from her bio, and I think it's worth quoting because it's really funny. This woman defines herself as Marxist-Leninist, anti-racist, anti-imperialist, anti-Zionist, but ethnically Jewish, pro-LGBTQ, pro-indigenous, international feminist. And this is a good example, he says, the author of what he calls as a Jew. Another recent, last few days, scandal in Israel, I don't know if you heard about it, worth mentioning, is connected to the name of a Professor Nadira Salhub Kevorkian. I don't know if you heard it. This woman is of the Hebrew University. She's a professor of the Hebrew University. I think she works in the social work department. She's a professor. She's quite known, I guess. In a podcast, it was aired a few days ago, she says, among many other things, of course, that the story of rape and murder of children on October 7th are all lies. Salhub Kevorkian is a Haifa-born Arab Christian. She lives now in the Armenian Quarter in East Jerusalem. She actually in England, and she of course gives she was later the Hebrew University stopped her teaching for she didn't fire her, but she cannot stay. But anyway, it's a vacation now, and she's immediately, of course, went on interviews, and the university is blamed of not letting hurting the freedom of speech, etc., etc. Anyway, so there's a whole scandal here, but I mention it because not because of this, but because on another podcast or webinar, she repeats what the things that I said, I think, and one of the audience of the people present there was Judith Butler, and I couldn't ignore the face of the atmosphere in this small group in this webinar. Air of complete identification with the speaker, with a big empathy, compliancy. This is why I mentioned it here. And this is also typical. Also typical is the woman. I'm talking about Judith Butler, who is a quite famous philosopher, let's say. She is a specialist in women's studies, in LGBTQ studies, and she is a very She's an anti-Israeli and anti-Zionist, and has published a lot on this subject in many ways. So, Butler is a Jew, and she let every time her Jewishness being part of what she's talking about or what she's saying. This is exactly as a Jew phenomenon or syndrome. She talks as a Jew, and as a Jew and as a former Zionist, she was educated in a Zionist story, she was in Israel, etc. This is a very common story that beat itself often. And these people speaks as if they have a certain knowledge by the fact that they are Jews and a certain moral authority that give extra weight to their anti-Israelism. And of course, as we know, and as it happened many times before in history, this serves well the ideological enemies of Israel. Well, so I this is the this phenomenon of Jews participating in this Judeophobic anti-Israelism is the thing I want to concentrate on. Usually, this is not new, of course, and a lot of has been written about it. The most important known is perhaps the we often used to this phenomenon as anti-Semitism or self-hatred. And the most famous, the most I think the most famous book about it is Sander Gilman's book. Jewish Self-Hatred, it's called. And I also had a friend of mine, the late now, died not very long time ago, the name Jacob Golomb, also wrote a book with the same title, more or less. So this is a subject that is repeated and discussed a lot. However, I think that self-hatred is not the right term to talk about this. And if anything, when I talk, I look at the faces of people like Judith Butler, or the other day was the director Jonathan Glazer, saying a few things about this, and others. They don't hate themselves, not at all. If anything, they feel as if they talk from high moral grounds, as if they have a certain, I think that as if they have a certain, as I said, a special moral and political and historical authority to talk about these things. And if anything, I think we can talk about some kind of moral narcissism, which described them better. Okay, so this phenomena I'm talking about is, of course, make many of us very, very angry and outraged. I am outraged by it, but I think it's a huge moral failure, this kind of discourse. But I think we have to look in a larger historical perspective in order to understand this. These phenomena are not new. We witness them, as I said, when it comes to the contemporary manifestation of it. It began at least at the beginning at the 80s, which means it's about 40 years ago. And we and in general, anti-Zionism dates from the very beginning birth of Zionism, especially in many quarters, and the most effective of them was, I think, in the communist world. But I want to look a little bit in a different perspective, and here it is when I want to propose a short examination of two case studies, Spinoza, Baruch, Benedicto Spinoza, and Hannah Arendt. And I propose here to take a few seconds of deep breath and then begin with a more relaxed manner. And I propose to begin exactly with a kind of little imagination game. Imagine that Spinoza, well, I guess you know that Spinoza was excommunicated. He was born in Amsterdam, in the Jewish Portuguese community of Amsterdam, which was exceptional in many ways. And he was excommunicated when he was 24. And then he left the community and kind of never looked back. And there is a whole many stories going around, and he was exhorted by the rabbis, by the panasim, by the leaders of the community to change his ways, to pretend he was a part of the community. They didn't ask him to give up his opinions, apparently, but only to behave as if he was one of them. Anyway, imagine that he had not been communicated by the community, that he obeyed or accepted the exhortation of the rabbis and the panasim, that he came on Shabbat to the synagogue and did everything that was demanded of him. Rabbi Cook, the famous Rabbi Cook, thinks that if he had stayed and continued his studies in the yeshiva, he would have become a modern Maimonides. More likely, he would have left the yeshiva and continue being a conversant like his father. But imagine that he remained in the community. He would have never become the kind of culture hero. And of course, one of the most famous and important philosophers of the Western culture, of Western philosophical tradition, he was in the end. He would have been one of those little Jews living in Amsterdam. Now let's do the same kind of exercise with Hannah Arendt. Let's imagine that instead of fleeing to the United States from France, when the war broke, the Second World War, she had moved like some of her friends, like Hans Jonas, who was a very close friend, and Gershom Scholem was another friend. She would move, Kurt Blumenfeld and some others would move to Jerusalem and settle down in Rehavia or in Ben Yehuda Street in Tel Aviv, which we call Ben Yehuda Straße, because there are so many what we call Yekes, Jews of German origin who lives there. She would have become probably another professor at the Hebrew University, like her friends, many of her friends who lived there. I know people who think that in all from all the places in the world, Rehavia, this where this professor lived, was the place where she felt the best, the more comfortable, most comfortable in the world. Maybe. It is possible. Anyway, she would. What would happen to her if she was, if she had stayed in, if she had come to Jerusalem instead of going to the United States, to New York, and become a professor at the university? She would have never been the kind of culture hero she is now. There is a famous all over the world, read, discussed. There are in Germany and in other places, there are all kinds of things called after her. There is no other university, the Hebrew University professor who has so much noise, I would say, around him or her as Hannah Arendt. So This is only I'm telling this story that I asked to do this kind of exercises in order to say the following. For both Arendt and Spinoza, the Jewishness was an obstacle. It was an obstacle on the way of universal fame, of becoming a universal figures and dealing with universal issues. And I think that this inner tension between what I propose to call a kind of passion for universality that characterizes these two figures, this inner tension between the Jewishness and the weight of Jewish particularity and the aspiration for to universality, to be part of the a citizen of the world, is a paradigm of modern Jewish existence. And it's and these two people, Arendt and Spinoza, exemplify it very nicely, very vividly. Now, both of them, Spinoza, after all, more than Hannah Arendt, are first-rate thinkers. Spinoza is one of the great, is considered to be one of the greatest philosophers in of the Western tradition. I don't think he died about 100 years ago, and we are still reading his writings as if they were written yesterday. I don't think this would happen with Hannah Arendt as well, but she is of course first-rate. In many ways, intellectual and writer. Now, for both of them, this tension between the Jewishness and the quest for universality burst, I would say, in almost in a very strong way in a few of the writings. Spinoza, let me say a few words on Spinoza first. One of the most important writings of Spinoza is what is called the Tractatus Theological Politicus, the political, the theological political treatise. And it is based on a critique, very severe critique of Jewish biblical theology, and in fact, in a more general way, a critique of monotheistic morality, and on the way, it undermines all the basic categories and concepts of monotheistic religion. But he directs his attack to the Jewish tradition. And he means other things. He means basically to undermine the aspiration of certain whole Dutch party, theocratic party, but he does it by attacking the Jews. And the point is that the legend has it that part of this book is an apologia, as it's called, is a self-defense writing that he prepared after he was excommunicated to defy the rabbis who excommunicated him. It was never published as such, and we are not sure that it has ever existed, but it is part of the book itself. No doubt, I think that Spinoza comes makes his account with the Jews in this book. And it's certainly something that weighted on him very heavily. With Arendt, it's not altogether different. Of course, the most important book in this vein is her book on the on Eichmann in Jerusalem, and the way it has become really a kind of a Bible for anti-Israeli discussion. But there is more to it. Arendt is said often to be a Zionist for a while. When she flew from Germany after the Nazis came to power, and she found shelter in Paris, and she was there until the war broke off. And during this time, she had connection with the some Zionist organization, and even escorted a group of young people, kids, that what is called Aliyat HaNoar sent to settle in Israel. And she went with them to Israel. And the legend said that she was Zionist at the time. Well, she wasn't. How do we know? Not very long time ago, was published a draft of an article that she wrote during this very time, when she was still linked to these Zionist groups and going to Israel. She wrote a draft of an article that was published later and under the title of Zionism Reconsidered, and is considered to be her final formal break with Zionism. And this happened after the Biltmore Convention, still during the Second World War. And she said there more or less that she thinks that, well, first of all, the idea to establish a state is wrong, it will never work, and it will fail for certain, etc., and many other things. But she thought so, as we now know, already when she was in Paris. So she wasn't a Zionist, but she wasn't anti-Zionist as well. She was, as I said before, probably the best, the most, she felt the most comfortable in Jerusalem or in Israel. And we know now that she visited Israel quite often, but every time she came, her husband, Heinrich Blicher, waited for her in Athens. He wouldn't come to Israel for ideological reasons. And there is a very interesting piece by one lady called Edna Brooke. She is the daughter of her best friend and her cousin, who were married and lived in Israel in Ben Yehuda Strasse. And the daughter was a Sabra. She was born in Israel, and she wrote a piece called Aunt Hannah, about her and her visits to Israel. And she tells, one of the anecdotes she tells was during her visit in Israel during the Eichmann trial, there was a military parade. And she was, Edna Brooke, her name, tells about the excitement Hannah felt when she watched Jewish tanks goes through the streets of Jerusalem. But at the same time, she says she was fighting against this feeling. And this hesitation and inner tension was obvious for this 17-year-old girl who was watching her then. So what I want to say, there is, and both Hannah Arendt and Spinoza shared what I called or tried to call or describe as a passion for universality or universalism. Universalism, this is in a way a reawakening or of neo-Paulinism, because Paulus, Shaul HaTarsi, actually a Jew from Tarsus in Turkey of today, he invented, as people said, universalism. Actually, we can go further and find this universalism also already in the Bible, in the prophets, and in the very idea of one God who created the whole world. But anyway, Christianity is based on this Paulinian conception of universalism. The problem is that it came together with a kind of rejection of Jewish particularism, and we see this duality goes all the way in history until today, and we see many Jews and Israelis somehow sharing it. And this explains much of this as a Jew phenomenon, I believe. The last word, as a conclusion, I would like to add is that around the figures and the person of both Spinoza and Arendt, there was weaved a whole cult or hagiography, which is more symbolic than really expression of the value of the works. Although both of them are, as I said, are first rate, Spinoza more, but Arendt too, the hagiography around is not explainable by the value of the work. It's symbolic. For instance, just to give you one example, Spinoza has become in France after 68 the heir of Marx, the new prophet of the ex-Marxist and ex-communist. And this has very little to do with the actual content of his work, but the symbolic weight of his person takes over. Where does it come from? I think it comes from the fact that these two, and there are many, but these two in particular, their Jewishness and the fact that they were renegade Jews, dissident Jews, plays a role in the fact that they have become such symbols. And if you think about why it is so, I think that this can explain to us a little better this as a Jew phenomenon that we witness now with all its ugliness. Well, I think it's about time to finish here. So I shall stop. And if there are questions, I, of course, should be happy to answer.